Host of the Lifeboat Hour, the number one show on Progressive Radio Network, right behind our founder, Gary Null. Join us every Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern for a soulful gut check on the status of our troubled planet and what you can do to try and adapt to it. This is from a nightclub at the end of the world. In the midst of heavy discussion, we also bring you a special and unique musical message from my band, New White Trash, and other very special artists. You can find all of our shows in the PRN archives for convenient listening at prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, my name is Doug Rocky. I'm the host of a brand new radio show, Warrior Connection. The purpose of this radio show is to provide current military and veterans with input and resources to look at the health and environmental effects of military operations. The show will be aired on Sunday night at 7 Eastern Time. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hi, it's Paul Cavalcante with The Vinyl Experience. Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern and anytime in the archives. The Vinyl Experience. Great recordings spun from LP records. The culture of recording. Hi-fi and record collecting. Lots of cool music from the motherlode of record albums that I've built up through the years as a DJ on New York City radio. The Vinyl Experience. It's a blast from the past, present, and future. CDs, cassettes, 8-tracks have all come and gone, but vinyl is here to stay. The Vinyl Experience, Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern at PRN.FM. Give vinyl a spin. Load your iPod with past shows from the archives. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here to wish you all a happy, happy New Year's. I hope you all had a wonderful celebration and took this new year to heart and came up with some good resolutions for the new year. I know I sent out a list of 15 and posted them. Actually, I added to that. I think there's 18 now. Added to it on my website. And they are resolutions that I am really going to work on, not only my own personal resolutions, which are, of course, eating well and getting plenty of exercise, but resolutions going forward to get involved in our food system and in making change. And my guest today is a real mover and shaker, and I'm really thrilled to have Winona Howder on my show. She is the executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she came out with a new book called Foodopoly, and she will be joining us in a little while. And that's very exciting because she has so much to share with us. And, of course, I have a recipe to share with you. But I wanted to just share with you some of the things that are going on here in New York and share with you some of my resolutions. So in addition to just getting involved in the food system, I wanted to ask all of you to get involved in calling Governor Cuomo's office. We have 8 days left to let him know what we think about fracking. Fracking is set to be approved in New York State, and there's a comment period that will be ending in 8 days. And we need at least 50,000 more comments to flood his office speaking out against fracking. And for those that do not know, fracking is the process of releasing gas that is locked in the shale rock underneath, you know, miles and miles down underneath the ground. And they go into communities and they extract this gas. And while they're doing it, they are having millions and millions of gallons of contaminated water and gas to dispose of and they have nowhere to dispose of it. And they're polluting our water, and it's just creating havoc on the communities and lighting people's water on fire. And it is just such a bad thing, and we really need to speak out against it and get involved in encouraging and demanding that our government represents the people and not the corporations. And that is so much what we'll be talking about later on in the show with Renona. Right now, our society is set up to consider corporations and big business as more valuable than individuals. And we have to speak out and let them know that that is not true, that we are the taxpayers, we are the ones that really matter, and that profitability and greed has to do away with that. That's just not going to take us forward. And if we want our planet to survive the next 100 years for and beyond, an old Indian proverb says every decision you have to think out 7 generations beyond yours to really know if it's a good decision or not. And that has not been happening, clearly has not been happening. The FDA has just moved forward with genetically engineered salmon. They have loads and loads of scientists, congressmen, many people saying that they don't want it, and yet they ignore the science, they ignore the voices of the people, and they move forward with it. And they were saying that this genetically engineered salmon was going to be sterile and would not be able to breed with salmon out in the wild, and that's not true. They have now found the salmon will be able to breed, and Aqua Bounty is the biotech company that's developed this frankenfish. And they say there's little risk, but that's not true. A team of Canadian scientists who observed the breeding behavior of Aqua Bounty's genetically modified salmon and wild salmon for 2 years found that they can indeed mate and that they do indeed get out of their pens. So there's no such thing as, all these companies that say, they set up, safe ways for drilling in the Arctic and safe ways for the pipeline from Canada down to the Gulf. And there's no such thing. We witness year after year after year major, major accidents that happen. And then the cleanup we all pay for. The companies, supposedly pay for it, but they don't really. Years and years down the road, we're still paying for it. So, and it does, wreaks havoc on the environment. And so we really need to all become politically involved, because just, talking about it is not enough. And yes, we are all talking about it more, but we need to get everybody on board. And so that takes each and every one of us to really go out there and spread this word and to actually get involved. Make those phone calls to Governor Cuomo. Write a letter to your congressman and let them know how you feel about the GE salmon. And then boycott the companies that are promoting, and funding no labeling of our food, such as Honest Tea, which, people are drinking Honest Tea. They think it's a great company, but it's owned by Coca-Cola, and they donated $1.7 million to defeat Proposition 37. Muir Glen, the same thing. They're owned by, I'm actually not sure who they're owned by. They're owned by one of the big corporations. I don't have that in front of me, but they also donated over $1 million to defeat Proposition 37. So I'm boycotting Muir Glen, which is difficult for me because I actually like their products. My kids are addicted to their salsa, their corn and bean salsa, and of course, Whole Foods has come out with one, but it's not organic. And so if you're committed to organic, you want to buy organic, because that's the only thing that protects us somewhat from the ingredients in the food. And even the organic food, as we will learn later on in the conversation with Winona, because the organic companies are all being owned by these mega huge corporations, they are all pushing to weakening our organic standards. So if something's not available or it's too expensive, they can just sneak in something that's not as good quality and get away with it. And so we all just have to, wise up to that and do what we can. So I do want to share with you a recipe before I invite Winona on. I know over a year ago I shared this recipe, but it's come back to people asking me again and again. I made it this year for a Christmas party, and people just cannot believe it's a vegan lasagna. So it's a vegan pesto lasagna, and I promise you it is as creamy and delicious as any lasagna you've ever had. So it does not taste healthy, if that's a concern for you. It's full fat. It's not low calorie, I'll tell you that. But it is delicious, and certainly is less calorie, though, than a regular lasagna. There's no cheese in it at all. And I also use rice noodles, so it's also gluten-free friendly for anybody who's gluten-free. However, it does use soy. I use tofu. So if you have an allergy to soy, it will take some readjusting. But even that is possible. You can use cashews and make the mock ricotta cheese out of a cashew cream instead of tofu. Okay. So the vegan pesto lasagna, what you want first to make the pesto is 4 cups of basil leaves, 8 cloves of garlic, 3/4 cups of toasted pine nuts, 1 cup of olive oil, and 3/4 cups of salt and pepper to taste. And you're going to pulse all that in a food processor. You start with the basil and pulse it till it's chopped really fine. Then you add the garlic, the garlic, the salt, and the pepper, and then the pine nuts. And the pine nuts I do toast first. If you're at Trader Joe's, you can buy them already pre-toasted, which is great. Otherwise, you want to toast them either in a pan or in the oven. They're so expensive, so be careful not to burn them. And that brings out more of the nutty flavor. And that just is universal anytime I'm using nuts, unless I'm doing a raw recipe. I like to toast the nuts first because it does bring out the flavor. So you're going to pulse all the makings in the food processor and scrape down the sides to incorporate all the mixture. And when it's fully pureed, that's when you're going to add the olive oil. And you're going to leave the food processor running and add the olive oil slowly through the opening in the top. And that will emulsify the mixture and make it thick. And, you know, you might taste it and add a little more salt if needed. And the salt is taking the place of the ricotta, of the Parmesan cheese that you usually add into the pesto. Then for the filling of the lasagna, you need 1 cup of unsweetened soy milk or rice milk, 2-pound block of firm tofu, 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar, and then 1 cup of the pesto that you just made. And you're going to puree that all in the food processor. Then you also need 1 cup of chopped onions, 1-pound bag of frozen spinach, and 1 tablespoon chopped garlic. And, of course, you can use fresh spinach if you want. You just need a lot of it to get a pound. Then you want 1 32-ounce jar of marinara sauce. And I buy an organic marinara that you can get from, you know, any health food store or Trader Joe's or wherever. And if you want to add any sautéed vegetables to that, garlic, white wine to doctor up the marinara sauce, you can. Or, of course, if you have your own marinara sauce, that's the best. A box of organic rice lasagna noodles and 1/2 cup chopped parsley. And then I also do buy either a soy or a rice mozzarella type cheese that I use just on the top, really just for a visual. I don't put it in it, and I don't think it adds any flavor, but it does make it look more like a lasagna. So I will add that at the very end, you know, like 10 minutes before I take it out of the oven, just to allow it to melt a little bit. So you made the pesto already. For the sauce, you're going to saute the onion, garlic, red pepper if you'd like, in some olive oil, add 1/4 cup of white wine, cook for about 5 minutes, and then add your jarred sauce to that and add 1/4 cup of chopped parsley. And also in a saute pan, I saute the onions with the spinach and 1 tablespoon of chopped garlic, and I add a little salt to that as well. And in the food processor, you're going to combine the tofu, the rice milk, the vinegar, and the pesto and pulse that until smooth. And then you're going to have all the different parts ready to layer. You have the the tofu pesto filling, you have the sauteed spinach, and you have the sauce. And first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to put some sauce down into my casserole pan. You can either use, you know, a glass Pyrex or a stainless steel or ceramic casserole lasagna pan. Put the sauce down first, then I take the noodles right out of the box. You do not have to cook the noodles first. You do not need to buy any special noodle that says, you know, no boil lasagna noodle. That's just a hype. Any lasagna noodle will work. Layer down your lasagna noodles, and I don't overlap it because I really want it to cook in the sauce, so you need it to be flat. And so if I have like a half a width of lasagna noodle on the edge left, I break one of the lasagna noodles in half, and sometimes it might break into little pieces, and I just kind of puzzle it in there so that I have one flat, even layer of lasagna noodles. Then I use half of the filling of the tofu and pesto, and I cover the noodles with that. Then I put some sauce on top. Then I put another layer of lasagna noodles. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to put the spinach down. After I put the tofu pesto in, I sprinkle half of the spinach and onion mixture. Then I put the sauce. Then I put the noodles again, the sauce, the pesto ricotta cheese mixture, not the ricotta cheese, pesto tofu, sauce again, and finish on top with the noodles, and then just put sauce on top. Okay, and then you bake it in the oven for about 40 minutes. Then I remove it from the oven, and I will add the mozzarella cheese and put it back into the oven for about another 20 minutes or so. And when you're cooking it the first round, for the first 40 or 50 minutes, cover it with tin foil so that it's really baking closed and covered. And then when you add the mozzarella cheese or the rice mozzarella cheese on top, you can take the cover off. And you know it's ready when you can, you know, stick a fork into it and it you can pierce it easily. And then it's ready. And you can let it sit for, you know, 5 minutes or so before serving. Just allow it to set. And it's really great. And it's also great made, you know, a couple days before and then reheated. It works really well. It's not as good frozen. I actually haven't frozen it, but I don't love tofu frozen. I don't love rice noodles frozen. So it's best made, you know, fresh or a few days beforehand. And that's my recipe. I'd love some comments. If you do make it and you love it as much as we do over here, let me know about that. One of my New Year's resolutions, I should say, is to finish my cookbook that I started years ago and have never really finished. So I'm hoping to put that to paper and get that out to all of you who have been asking. So now it is my pleasure to invite Winona Hawter onto my radio show. She is the executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she's worked extensively on food, water, energy, and environmental issues at the national, state, and local level for all of her working life. Her new book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America, examines the corporate consolidation and control over our food system and what it means for farmers and consumers. And I'm going to let Winona tell us more about her book and all the experience she has. I mean, she has worked with Public Citizens Energy Environmental Program. She's worked with Citizens Action. She's worked with the Union of Concerned Scientists, that's what I wanted to share, which is another wonderful organization. I look to the Union of Concerned Scientists a lot for some of my information that I share with all of you, as well as Food and Water Watch, which is a great organization. So, Winona, are you there?
I'm here. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Well, welcome. Your work and the history of your life is amazing. And your work is so important. So thank you for writing Foodopoly. And
well, thanks.
And sharing this information with everyone. What prompted you to actually write the book?
Well, you know, I have spent years working on food policy, and it's become increasingly frustrating that our wonderful good food movement leaves out some of the most important issues in the policy work that it does. And I think that that's basically because people don't know about the structural problems with the food system. You know, we hear a lot of times that it's subsidies that's causing the problems. And, of course, the subsidy program is a problem, but it's a symptom of a dysfunctional system. It's not the cause. And so I decided to write a book that would tackle and lay out these deeper issues so that we could begin to talk about them and add them to the work that we're doing, because in the long term, we're going to really have to change the structure of our food system and, of course, the economic structure of our country as well. So, you know, today we have 20 food corporations that produce most of the food eaten by Americans, even organic brands. We have four large chains, including Walmart, that control more than half of all grocery store sales. And we have one company that dominates the organic grocery industry, Whole Foods, of course, and one distribution company that has a stranglehold on getting organic products into communities around the country. And then, of course, we've also had science run amok with the biotechnology industry becoming so powerful that it can literally buy public policy. And so I think it's just critical to understand how all of these issues play into creating the food system that's making people sick and fat.
God, you lay that out so easily, and it makes me want to cry. You know, it's like, where does one start? I mean, is this book intended, do you think, for people new to these issues or people that are already good food activists?
I think this book can be read by either. Every chapter is independent, so you don't need to read the book all the way through from cover to end in order. You can read the areas that are of greatest interest to you. And what I try to do is lay out the history of farm policy in a way that makes it actually interesting. One of the things that I found really amazing when I started doing the research for this book is that it was really after World War II that the titans of industry got together and they created this this association, business association called the Committee for Economic Development, that started determining which policies would make industry most profitable. And one of the things that they decided was that there were too many farmers and that we needed to, I love one of these quotes from some of their materials, we need to, quote, get those boys off the farm. And so they laid out a program for doing away with a lot of the New Deal programs that had helped farmers actually become profitable. And over the course of time, these programs were chipped away, and that really has led to part of this dysfunctional system. That, along with, of course, the Reagan administration's deregulatory agenda, and that's when antitrust law was really eviscerated. So we can trace all of these large corporations and the merger and acquisition frenzy that we've seen back to the Reagan administration, which stepped in and decided that it was okay for companies to get as big as possible, too big to fail, right? Not just in food, but in every industry. But in the food industry in particular, we have consolidation. And I think one of the things that people don't realize is how consolidated the organic food industry is and how these large companies now play too large a role in public policy making. Today, the 14 of the 20 largest food processors have acquired organic brands or introduced organic versions of their products to the market. You were mentioning Muir Glen, that's owned by General Mills. They also own Cascadian Farms, Labrador Bar, and Food Should Taste Good brands. So, you know, we see this kind of corporate control of organics, and then they influence the organic standards and attempt to weaken them to make organics more profitable.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, it's really so horrible. I mean, you know that, you know, some nice food lover started an organic company as a small company, and then they become successful, and the next thing you know, they're being bought out by one of these big companies. And then, as you said, those big companies put the pressure on to try to weaken the standards. That's why the organic, the U.S. Organic Standards organization is, you know, filled with people that have worked within these biotech companies and these big food corporations. And, you know, there's this conflict of interest in so many of these organizations that these organizations that were set up supposedly as protection that you can't trust.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, the National Organic Standards Board is really important to anyone who cares about organics. It's an advisory committee that's appointed by the Secretary of Agriculture to develop the standards that are given approval by the USDA, and it plays a very important role in determining what is organic and what isn't organic. And this is something that people really need to tune into, because the board has meetings where they determine basically what's going to be organic, whether synthetic chemicals are going to be considered organic or not. And there are many battles that are fought there, and these big companies are playing too large a role at the board. You know, for instance, the guidelines are allowing organic products and ingredients to be sourced from around the world wherever they're cheapest. And, you know, this gives the large companies like Dean Foods or Hain Celestial an advantage. And so I would say that that's one of the other policy areas that have been so important to our food system, and that's the global trade rules, because allowing food production to be globalized has not only weakened organic food, it's basically helped make farming unprofitable, especially for fruits and vegetables, because so many of those products are offshored now. In fact, China's become one of the biggest players, biggest five players in importing produce to the United States. So, you know, we're going to need to really inform and educate people about all of these issues so that we can begin to build the political power to change things. And I think that's why your show is so important and why food literacy is so important.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to hear more and more colleges. We need to bring it down even to the high school level, but more and more colleges are starting to offer this food literacy work and courses at the university level. I know my intern that I've had, actually she's really more my assistant now, came to me right out of college. She's been with me now for 3 years, and you know, that's where she first got turned on to all of these issues, was, you know, through a class where I think it was food politics, basically. And it's so important for more and more people to know about this and to, you know, read the type of work that you just came out with.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think that youth and college students can play a major role in this, and we need to make sure that we're reaching them as an audience, because if you get too much of your information from the mainstream media, you won't understand these issues. So it's very exciting to
see. Of course, because they've also been deregulated.
That's right, exactly. So I think that these courses on campus are just so important, and there's a lot of food activism on campus. It's also why we don't want to pick out the wrong policies or simplify things too much. I mean, there's no silver bullet to fixing the food system. These are really hard issues and are going to take changes over a period of time.
Do you think, do you see this consolidation getting worse over the next 5 to 10 years, or do you think with this this new education generation, more people becoming aware of it, that there's a little hope there?
Well, I think we are going to see more consolidation, because the only way that we can stop this is to change the federal policies that are creating the consolidation in all industries. I mean, we have an economic system where all of the rhetoric is wrapped around how we need competition. But when you allow massive concentration and consolidation of industries, you're doing the opposite from having competition. When you have a store like Walmart that where 1 out of 3 grocery dollars are spent, and where the Walmart heirs have more wealth than the 40% lowest income Americans, you know, there's a problem with that. So we need to add into the policies that we're talking about, we need to talk about these antitrust violations and how antitrust law has basically been done away with. And we need to get that out there as one of the major problems, rather than focusing on some of the side issues. You know, for instance, subsidies. I think when you ask most people in the good food movement, what's the biggest issue that has to be changed to fix the food system, a lot of people will say, well, we have to get rid of subsidies. Well, the subsidy system was instituted after the deregulation that took place in 1996. The Farm Bill that passed took all of the programs away that helped manage the overproduction of commodity crops. And so the price of corn and soy went way down, which actually helped the grain traders, the meat industry, because they had cheap feed, and it helped the food processors who need corn and soy as an ingredient in their food. But in the good food movement, we often hear that it's the farmers that are greedy, the greedy welfare queens who are perpetrating the subsidy system. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at small and mid-sized farmers and look at the most recent farm data on income, small and mid-sized farmers made an average of $19,274, and that about 50% of that comes from the government payments. So,
wow. Winona? We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear more about what Winona found out when she was researching her book. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I've been talking with Winona Hauter, who is the Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and we're talking about her new book, Foodopoly. And Winona, are you with us?
I'm here.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Sorry about that before. I don't know
what actually happened, but I'm glad you're back with us.
Yes, absolutely. Well, what I was saying is that the biggest beneficiaries of the subsidy program actually aren't the farmers, even though, you know, there is abuse and there are large farms that get subsidies, and of course the system needs to be reformed. But the biggest beneficiaries have been the grain traders, the meat industry, and the food processors who benefit from the overproduction, this deregulation of farm policy. And if you look at the numbers, Tufts University estimates that the soft drink companies saved almost $1 billion during a 9-year period after deregulation when corn prices were lowered. And they estimate that the meat industry saved nearly $4 billion on animal feed because of this deregulation.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it's really the subsidy system kind of keeps the farmers afloat, but these industries are the real beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I know when you were researching for your book, Foodopoly, you interviewed many experts in the field. Can you share with us a few of the people you interviewed who are doing the most impressive work to fix our food system?
Absolutely, I'd love to. I think, well, I just mentioned Tufts University, and I think that they are doing some amazing work. Tom Wise, who's the Director of Research and Policy at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts, has done a lot of the research about the impact of global trade and the effect on farmers of trade and of kind of this corporatization of our food system. And his department has pointed out that if we actually want to have a sustainable food system in the future, then we need the small and mid-sized farms to actually survive and thrive. These people are kind of between a rock and a hard place, and we need to help them to actually be able to transition. I think that someone else who I really relied upon in putting this book together has actually passed away, but he wrote a fabulous book. I knew him in the 1980s and 90s. His name was Al Krebs, and he wrote a book called The Corporate Reapers, The Book of Agribusiness, which I used a lot in the history in finding the history of the farm movement, and then looking at the sources he used and then going to the original sources, because, you know, so much of what has been done has been lost because it actually isn't taught. I mean, we've had this long history in this country of farmers being political leaders, being progressives in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, and kind of looking at that farm history and some of the policies that they fought for was really interesting and beneficial in putting this book together. Also, there were some social scientists that I interviewed and who were very helpful. Dr. Bill Heffernan and Dr. Mary Hendrickson from the University of Missouri, they have been real pioneers in documenting the foodopoly, and their excellent research on consolidation in the food system and the impact that this has had on consumers and farmers was really very beneficial. And then I must say that, you know, a big reason that I wrote Foodopoly is to kind of inspire the food movement to go beyond voting with our forks, which is important and certainly important for the individual, but collectively we have to be politicized and become political. And the Midwest Academy, which is a grassroots organizing academy, has been very important in kind of forming the way I think about how you build political power. People like Steve Max and Jackie Kendall and David Hunt. And so the last part of the book is really about the policies that we need to change and to inspire people to go out in their communities, because all organizing is local. We need to organize at the state, at the local level, at the state level, and then eventually we can build power to begin doing things at the federal level. And I know with the composition of Congress today and all of the battles over the budget, it seems really discouraging to people, but we really have no choice. We have to go out and do this political organizing. And so I think it's really important in thinking about how we break down these problems and begin addressing them. And, you know, I think of the labeling of genetically engineered food is one of the entry points, because most consumers agree that genetically engineered food should be labeled. Now, we've just seen the industry spend a lot of money to defeat a proposition in California. We thought that proposition was a little premature, that we needed to do a lot of education before we moved into doing an initiative. But the initiative itself has ended up being very beneficial in that it's educated a lot of people.
Right,
we
right.
need to do these campaigns at the state level, and I'm not necessarily talking about initiatives. They're very difficult, and the industry can raise a lot of money to defeat them in a very short period of time. But I'm talking about doing more legislative campaigns with the view that this is going to take 3-5 years to be able to actually get this labeling in place. But, you know, we have to start somewhere, and we need to break these issues down, and we need to give people hope that we can actually change things, because I think corporate America actually benefits from people thinking these problems are too big and there's nothing I can do, and why bother to vote, or why bother to do anything political because everything's lost anyway.
Yeah, I think so many people feel that way. I even sometimes start to feel that way, and I know that I can't allow myself to fall into that abyss. But
well, that's right. And, you know, you were talking about fracking earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that the industry has been able to go into these communities and frack is, you know, decades of bad farm policy has made farmers unable to make a living. And if farmers can't make a living, the rural communities dry up and blow away, or their economic health is just taken away. So it's really important to start getting better farm policy in place to be able to fight these extractive industries. And I think that it's been amazing in New York, the collective power of the fracking movement, New Yorkers Against Fracking, the hundreds of groups that belong to that impressive coalition, and the fact that Como has so far not legalized fracking. And we know that this is continuing to be a battle, and it's important that people keep engaged in this issue. But, you know, these are the types of wins we see when people actually get involved.
Right, right. When you were gathering the information for Foodopoly, did you discover anything that surprised you?
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that was that most dramatized the dysfunction of our food system is what's going on in the poultry industry. And, you know, most people don't have a lot of sympathy for the poultry contract growers. Being a poultry, well, we basically, a lot of these people think of themselves as modern-day serfs. Most Americans have no idea that the chicken they eat is raised by a farm family that makes an average of $15,000 a year or less, and that the industry is, the profits all go to the companies like Tyson, Purdue, Sanderson Farms, and these companies have established a contract system where the farmer is like a chicken sitter more than a farmer. They're required to borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars to put up these, you know, chicken, disgusting chicken factories where you'll have 100,000 chickens squeezed into one facility. This is often a last-ditch effort to save the family farm because the USDA has been guaranteeing these loans. And so then the industry brings the birds. They own the chicks. They own the antibiotic-laced feed. They own and control every step of the production except for the waste. So the chicken contract grower owns the waste, and they are responsible for all of the terrible environmental problems, and they don't make any money. I mean, if you look at a $19 12-piece bucket of chicken in Manhattan, 25 cents goes to the grower, 3 to 5 cents goes to the, you know, the contract or the company like Tyson, and then the remainder of the $19 goes to KFC. You know, those are shocking statistics. And we really need to do something about the poultry industry because chicken is really not fit to eat. We were able, Food and Water Watch was able to have a campaign over the last 3 years in Maryland to get rid of arsenic in chicken feed. We'd like to see that happen nationally because it's outrageous that the chicken industry can use arsenic as a growth promoter in chicken feed. So anyway, I learned a lot about the meat industry that's really appalling. And
well, you know, like the chicken parts that they can't sell, they're now selling to these fish farms, and they're turning them into fish pellets.
That's
and
exactly
so the fish
right.
Fish are now being fed chicken parts.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That fish aren't supposed to be eating. So, you know, then even the health benefit of, you know, you eat fish because you want the omega-3s and all the, you know, benefits of eating fish that, you know, live on the plankton and the chlorophyll in the water, and now they're eating chicken parts. What happens to the nutritional value there, you know?
It's so true. And, you know, fish farming, which I don't really deal with in Foodopoly, but factory fish farming is a real problem, and it's really factory farmed fish is not really fit to eat.
So what do you think I know you said in your last chapter you talk about, you know, what people can do. What can people do?
Well, you know, we've just seen the Farm Bill, a really dysfunctional Farm Bill pass. So it's only a 9-month extension. It means that food activists have another shot at working at the Farm Bill.
So what, it was a 9-month extension is what?
Right, it was part of the fiscal cliff negotiation.
Okay.
Because you may have heard one of the issues was that milk prices were going to go way up because a 1949 law would go into effect that actually allowed dairy farmers to make the cost of production. I mean, that's an irony, is that dairy farmers are really hard hit these days. But anyway, so this very dysfunctional bill passed. It left out a lot of the most important programs for organic farmers and young farmers, and it reestablished the commodity programs in the 2008 Farm Bill. Now, people's eyes glaze over when you talk about the Farm Bill, but really it's the Food Bill. It's the bill where the food stamps, I mean, most of the money appropriated for the Farm Bill are for food stamps, which fortunately were not cut in this last-minute end-of-year action, even though right-wing forces want to, you know, get rid of the food stamp program. But there will be, over the course of the next several months, a big debate on the Farm Bill. people need to get involved in this debate and start raising with their elected members of Congress these more, these deeper structural issues, like why do we keep talking about competition, but we don't have any antitrust law? And people will be able to go to the Food and Water Watch website and see actions and things that they can do to be able to get involved in this important debate. But this is one of the things that people can do. Also, we're going to see in a number of states legislation to label genetically engineered food, and we absolutely have to do this because we are now seeing more and more food items become genetically engineered, and the Obama administration has been very, very friendly to the biotech industry. So we really need to drum up more interest, activity, and awareness about why we don't want genetically engineered food.
Yeah, well, you know, Obama, one of his first appointees was Tom Vilsack as the Secretary of Agriculture, was voted, you know, biotech governor of the year by Monsanto and the biotech companies.
That's right, and we've seen more biotech crops approved under the Obama administration than under the Bush administration, sadly.
And that's why, I mean, I know you talked about the National Organic Standards Board before as being a wonderful organization, but they're infiltrated by all of these people that have been appointed by Tom Vilsack.
Oh, well, you know, I think you misunderstood if you think that I said they were wonderful. I said they were important.
Okay. They're important, but we got to get good people in there. I think somewhere I was reading, you know, originally when it was set up and there was supposed to be consumers in there and, you know, producers of small organic companies. There were so many different levels of different people that were supposed to be in there, and they have been, it's been kind of whitewashed and changed. And so there's not, it doesn't, the people that make up the Organic Standards Board are not the components that were originally set up.
No, but we really have to watch their business. That's what I was trying to say, is that a lot of decisions are being made there, and we can't, I mean, these people can be embarrassed because, you know, they're supposed to be protecting the organic standards, and, you know, we need to do everything we can to bring, shed light on the advisory board meetings and what's happening and so forth. That's what I was trying to express.
Oh, great. So where do you go to find out, like, get some transparency from that?
Well, we have a staff member that attends every meeting, and we usually put up on the Internet an assessment of what's gone on at the meeting.
Okay.
But what we need to start doing is really getting almost action alerts, even though, you know, it's difficult because these are appointed people. They're not elected. But in their capacity in these different companies, I do think we have an opportunity to, you know, bring some transparency and put some pressure on people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. So do you think there's any real hope in reversing some of the deregulation, you know, that has taken place and reversing some of the antitrust laws?
You know, I do. If I didn't, I couldn't stay in this work. I mean, I think that we have to start at you know, the state level in local communities, educating people. I mean, it's why we've put a lot of our resources at Food and Water Watch into having state offices in places like Iowa and Michigan. We need to start building the pressure at the state legislation, at the state level, because these are the legislators that actually play a role in determining how congressional districts are made up. I mean, obviously, this is a long-term battle. The reason that we see the House of Representatives in such terrible shape right now is that the districts, the congressmen, come from are so gerrymandered by these often Republican, you know, usually in the past 10 years, this happens every 10 years, the state legislatures have been very right-wing, and so they have made sure that these districts are gerrymandered so that the congressmen that are voted upon are going to be very, very conservative. So we need to start bringing pressure at the state level and working on state campaigns and raising all of these issues at the state level, so that we can begin to change federal policy. And I think part of what we need to get out there is just to start talking about this antitrust issue, because people don't know. I mean, people, and it's not just in the food industry, it's in every single industry. Do we really want one airline, you know, one rental car company, one grocery store?
Well, the healthcare system, I mean, I see it there all the time, between insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, hospitals. I mean, hospitals are these huge mega conglomerations. Your little local hospital where you felt like you could actually get some one-on-one attention is now
absolutely
owned by these giants.
And this is the root of a lot of our economic problems. So I actually think that raising these issues related to food and beginning to get this on the agenda can actually begin to build pressure so that we can do something about this in the next, you know, 10 or 20 years. You know, I kind of always look at the long term, right? It took 50 years to make child labor in the U.S. illegal. It took more than 50 years to even make it legal to allow organizing to join a union. These are long-term battles, and we need to try and reestablish our democracy if we're going to also have a healthy food system. It's part of the same battle.
Yeah. Well, I think you and I share the common knowledge, or the not common knowledge, but the motivation and the desire to try to make change in our world and keep motivating people and sharing what you know with everybody, because hopefully we're going to make a difference.
Absolutely.
And I think your book does, and I want to thank you for joining us. We are unfortunately out of time.
Okay.
But it's been a pleasure to have you on, and why don't you just share the website of Food and Water Watch,
okay,
or Foodopoly.
Food and Water Watch is foodandwaterwatch.org, and Foodopoly has a website, foodopoly.org.
Great.
And people can find out where to get the book on the website.
And with Food and Water Watch, I know you can find out where you can get involved in your local area. So
absolutely.
Please, everybody, make this your New Year's resolution. We can't do this alone. We need everyone on board to make some change in our food and in our health and in our future for the planet. So on
thanks
that note,
so
everybody.
Much.
And thank you, Winona. Everyone have a great, great rest of the week, and I'll be with you again next week. Have a great one.